In today's episode of Dietitians Only, we're talking about solid organ transplant. Ever been curious about what it's like to work as a dietitian specializing in solid organ transplant? In today's episode, we hear from dietitian Emily Menez. She shares her experience working in this very unique area. Emily will discuss some of the steps of the organ transplant process, including screening, selection, and a dietitian's role in caring for these unique patients.
You're listening to Dietitians Only, a podcast from Dietitians on Demand, created by dietitians for dietitians. Let's get into it.
Hey, everyone, and welcome back to Dietitians Only. This is Sarah Glantz, and we have a special guest with us today. She's been on the podcast before. It's Emily Menez. She's our GI expert and fellow dietitian on the corporate team here. So say hello, Emily.
Hello, everyone. Excited to be back.
Yeah. So today, Emily's going to be talking a little bit about solid organ transplant surgery, which is something that she used to do when she was working full-time in the clinical setting. So Emily, do you want to start by telling us a little bit about solid organ transplant surgery and what that looks like?
Yeah. So solid organ transplant is a surgical procedure where a patient's primary organ that has either stopped working or is close to failing is removed and replaced with a healthy organ from a donor. The donor might be a living person, or it can be primarily going to be from deceased donors, just because there's not as many organs that can be donated by just a portion or a complete full organ donated from a living person. Other things to keep in mind, blood type is super important with organ transplant. You want to make sure that it's compatible between the donor and the recipient, just to ensure that the organ, the new organ, otherwise known as the graft after surgery, is able to function properly and not be rejected by the immune system.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. So that probably just throws an additional wrinkle into the process of trying to find two people that are compatible with each other.
Exactly, because the body's still going to try and reject the organ, even if the blood type is compatible. And that's why immunosuppression therapy is so important with organ transplant. But if it came from a different blood type, it can be more challenging.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what organs can actually be transplanted?
So organ transplant in the United States is going to be heavily guided by UNOS, or the United Network for Organ Sharing. So the organs that are currently approved by UNOS are heart, liver, kidney, pancreas, liver, small intestine, and vascularized composite allografts, otherwise known as VCAs, which is going to be face, hand, or the uterus. So in some cases, though, these organs might be simultaneous. So you might be getting multiple organs from one donor, which is going to be in the case of a deceased donor, which can often make the process a little bit more complicated as well.
So who all is involved on the interdisciplinary transplant surgery team, Emily?
So the transplant process is heavily regulated by CMS, or Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services. Each transplant center has to be approved by CMS for each respective organ that they are providing at their center. The transplant centers are going to be routinely surveyed for compliance and to maintain their approved transplant center status. So similar to how hospitals are, you know, having joint commission surveys, each hospital that has a transplant center is also having to go through the CMS transplant surveys as well. So part of that regulation and guidelines is the multidisciplinary team. There's a lot of different people that are involved, especially between different organs. But the main people you're going to see on that team is going to be the surgeons, the doctors that specialize in the particular organ. So cardiologists if it's heart transplant, hepatologists if it's liver transplant. There's going to also be certified transplant nurses, dietitians, social worker, transplant coordinators, pharmacists, and in some cases, palliative care or potentially chaplains.
Mm-hmm. Okay, gotcha. So I mean, it is a really complex process, so it makes sense that there would really need to be like an all hands on deck type of approach to it. So speaking of the process, can you tell us a little bit about the timeline and the process to get someone from start to finish?
Yeah. So there's going to be three main stages of transplant. So pre-transplant, peri-transplant, and then post-transplant. Each member of that transplant multidisciplinary team is going to be involved throughout all three stages and play a pretty critical role. In the pre-transplant stage, first things first, you're going to need to have insurance approval to go through the pre-transplant process. If you don't have that insurance approval, essentially the hospital or the outpatient clinic is not getting reimbursed for all of that workup because it's an all-inclusive pay through the insurance company. So once the transplant workup is ready to move forward, there's going to be a series of evaluations by healthcare providers as well as diagnostic and blood testing in order for them to be fully evaluated by the selection committee. So within that evaluation process, all of the providers that will need to see the patient are going to be, again, the doctor provider that is specific to that organ. So whether that's the cardiologist or hepatologist, the transplant coordinators need to see the patient as well. A social worker has to make sure they have appropriate social support. Psychiatrist or psychologist has to perform a psych evaluation to make sure that they're in an appropriate state of mind to go through such a big medical procedure. And then pharmacists and dietitians are also involved to make sure that there's no medication interactions or any compliance issues with medications from the pharmacy perspective. And from the dietitian perspective is making sure that, one, they are nourished enough to handle such a big surgery, and two, to assess, you know, dietary adherence and if they would be a good candidate for transplant since it's such a big lifestyle change.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that's pretty much going to be the first stage of things. The other portion that's going to be important within the pre-transplant realm is blood work and diagnostic testing. So there'll be a lot of things such as x-rays, ultrasounds. Again, it's going to be dependent on the organ, heart and lung tests, colonoscopy, dental exams. And then for women, they may have to go through like a PAP, gynecology exam, and a mammogram. So a lot of times they're just trying to rule out that there's any other issues that are underlying that could potentially affect the transplant surgery. And a lot of this might be dependent on the center itself. You know, a lot of programs have different policies in place as far as, you know, what goes into that pre-transplant evaluation. The next stage, the peritransplant, is basically just the time around the surgery. So this stage is going to focus more just on like supportive care, preparation for surgery, and maintain active status on the transplant list if they're not getting a living donor. And then the post-transplant stage is going to be immediately after surgery. All those same disciplines who had to do evaluations in the pre-transplant stage need to see this patient again at post-op to, you know, make sure things haven't changed depending on how long they might have been waiting for their transplant. And then the transplant team is going to collaborate throughout the transplant admission to ensure that the patient and the family have the appropriate support and education to ensure that the patient will do well upon discharge. The patient will also be followed pretty closely post-op, and then typically for the first year of transplant to make sure that you know, they're compliant, they're doing well, and that the graft is functioning appropriately.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. So it's a very complex process, like we discussed. Now you mentioned about the selection process. So what does that look like? I feel like that's such a mystery, like something mysterious that happens behind closed doors. So can you like do a little peek behind the curtain as far as what the selection process looks like?
Yeah. I mean, the selection committee is pretty interesting to be a part of. And in my experience with transplant, I've gone to, you know, three different organs for selection committee. So I've gone to heart, liver, and kidney, and they've all functioned very differently. I think it depends a lot on the type of organ, the providers involved, and, you know, potentially how many organs they're used to transplanting. So, you know, heart doesn't usually have as many organs transplanted per year as compared to kidney, which is typically the most, and then followed by liver. So it's a very interesting process. But usually all those interdisciplinary team members are going to be there, or at least one person from the team to kind of advocate for their area and for whoever did the evaluation. So within this process, typically a patient will be discussed before they even go through the pre-transplant evaluation as well. So kind of getting everybody's opinion on if they should even pursue the transplant workup. From there, once they go through the full transplant workup, they'll then be evaluated again and kind of go through all of the different disciplines as far as what their evaluation showed. And then at the end, they will determine if they should move forward with being listed for transplant and what that listing will be. Just there's different listings, which is probably too much to go into today, but as far as like how high up you are on the transplant list.
Mm-hmm.
And then in those committee meetings as well, they'll usually talk about people who are active on the transplant list and just kind of get an update about how they are, how they're doing, how they're progressing. But the typical things that we're going to keep in mind as far as transplant criteria to make you a good candidate to move forward with surgery, every center is going to vary depending on, you know, how strict they are within these criteria and what their actual criteria is. But some general, you know, topics that are discussed as far as if a patient can move forward is age, typically less than 70 years old. However, I've seen a patient who was 85 get transplanted. So every transplant center is a little different. BMI is an important factor as well. And this can just be from a surgical perspective as well. As you know, how they do after surgery. So sometimes a larger BMI just might be difficult to get into with surgical instruments. So that has been an issue before with abdominal surgeries. So typically we're looking for a BMI less than 35 to 40. And then on the other side of the spectrum, greater than 18.5, because somebody who's malnourished and underweight is probably not going to recover from surgery as well as if they had a higher BMI. Reliable social support is super important because transplant is such a big lifestyle change. You know, depending on the organ, you might not have as much mobility and things like that that you might have had before. So making sure that you have, you know, dedicated social support is probably the biggest thing with getting approved for transplant, as well as having active health insurance because the medications are very expensive and it's something that you can't just stop taking, because if you did, you'll reject your organ and then, you know, we're back to square one. You also need to make sure you're approved by psychology, because if your mental state is not in a good place for such a big lifestyle change, you're not going to be successful there as well. Same with medical adherence, you know, making sure that there hasn't been issues with medication compliance in the past, just because, again, that immunosuppression therapy is super important. No active illicit drug or excessive alcohol use as well, especially with liver transplant. Again, this is a center-specific guideline. A lot of centers have sobriety rules for liver transplant. The center I worked at did not. And so we had a lot of patients come from other centers, you know, so that kind of depends on the criteria as well. But, and then the last one to keep in mind is obviously no active cancers that have spread. So there might be a case where you have a liver transplant for hepatocellular carcinoma, but it can't be to a point where it has progressed and is spread to other organs.
Take a deeper dive into solid organ transplant with our on-demand webinar titled MNT for Solid Organ Transplant, or explore all of the other continuing education options available from Dietitians on Demand. There are more than 250 products in our shop, ranging from free infographics to in-depth trainings. Topics include nutrition support, malnutrition, long-term care, pediatrics, professional development, and so much more. Visit shop.dietitiansondemand.com today.
You know, you mentioned that CMS is involved with overseeing a lot of transplant programs and stuff like that. So who is it that, I know you said this criteria like center specific, but are there just some overarching rules, or where did these general guidelines come from, I guess is what I'm asking?
So CMS does have guidelines. They have a huge PDF on their website for transplant. That's probably like 100 pages long, but part of the approval process is having your policies for your center approved and looked at. So I think that that is really where it comes down to how specific the criteria is per center. And then, you know, that's something that's going to be evaluated when they're getting surveyed again for, you know, reapproval of their transplant center status. And so in that situation, they're also going to look at, you know, the center's statistics as far as how many successful surgeries they've had, how many organs have made it, you know, past a year, what's their mortality rate like, what's their rejection rate like. All of those things are going to come into play when getting a, you know, evaluated for their transplant status.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that makes sense. So some facilities may have stricter or looser guidelines depending on like what their survival rates. If they have poor survival rates, maybe they try to be a little bit more selective about who they choose, right?
Exactly. And a newer thing that is happening too is you know, some centers now are offering Hep C positive organs and then treating the Hep C when the patient gets the organ. So there's, you know, because there's a shortage of organs, there's a lot of, you know, the wait list for transplant is very long for particular organs, especially kidney. People might be waiting 5+ years to get a kidney transplant. And I mean, at least, you know, there's things like dialysis that can make, you know, life extend while you're waiting for the kidney to come. But certain organs like liver, you know, there's nothing comparable to dialysis for a liver that can help extend life. So I think, you know, there's been a big push of ways that we can kind of get around it, you know, to make sure that we can get all the organs we need for people who need them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, gotcha. So getting back to the interdisciplinary team, what is the dietitian's role when it comes to solid organ transplant? What could dietitians expect to be doing with these patients?
So dietitians are going to be involved throughout the 3 stages of transplant. From the pre-transplant perspective, you know, it's making sure that patients' nutrition status can support a major surgery like transplant, you know, assessing their weight trends, their nutrition and health knowledge, and diet adherence. So, you know, depending on the type of organ, there might be other dietary interventions or nutrition interventions that you're working on. So for instance, you know, with like a liver transplant patient, you might be focusing on, you know, a low sodium diet, eating enough protein. You know, if your patient's malnourished, working on how to get to a better weight status prior to surgery. And from the other end of the spectrum, if you have someone who, you know, is overweight or obese that you're looking to have them lose weight before surgery, you might be helping more from that side of things. But in that pre-transplant evaluation, the dietitian is essentially going to make a recommendation in their assessment if they think the patient is a good transplant candidate from a nutrition perspective. And then that would be discussed at selection committee. As far as like how much the interdisciplinary team cares about our assessment, it really varies. I mean, I think, you know, with the heart transplant population that I've worked with, I think they cared very much about the nutrition side of things, whereas other organs, they cared, but it wasn't going to hold them back. You know, if somebody was malnourished or obese, they might not hold them back, but they would just try and work on it in the meantime and list them regardless. And then from the, you know, post-transplant side, immediately post-op, the dietitian is going to see the patient, you know, even if they're in the ICU and, you know, ventilated, and then provide just your classic surgical post-surgical nutrition care. So it is going to be dependent on the patient, you know, what their nutrition and medical status was like before the transplant is going to dictate how involved the dietitian is post-op. So if it was someone who is in the ICU waiting for an organ, who was on tube feeds, they're probably still going to need that post-op while they recover. So just kind of assessing, you know, where your patient's at and how involved and how aggressive you have to be from a nutrition perspective. And then prior to discharge, the dietitian is heavily involved in education. So making sure that the patient and the family feel comfortable with the post-transplant diet, which is primarily just like food safety and making sure that they're eating enough. But the food safety side of things is something that usually people are not used to following because we're used to our immune system being able to help us if we ate something sketchy at a buffet. But after transplant, it's a more significant risk because if you are to get sick, anytime you get sick, you come to the hospital, you have an infection, they have to back off on your immunosuppression therapy to let your body try and fight off the infection a little bit. And so in that case, that's always a risk for your organ rejecting if we're having to back off on immunosuppression. So that's kind of the way it needs to be, you know, phrased to patients to kind of be like, it might not sound that serious, but it could potentially lead to something more serious. So that, and then obviously any other education that's more organ specific. So, you know, just kind of gauging what, you know, where your patient's at and what other education you might have to provide. And then there's typically a dietitian staffed in the transplant clinic to follow up if needed. It's not necessarily something that is followed as closely as in the other stages, but most transplant centers do have dietitians in the outpatient setting as well.
Okay. Well, this was awesome. I think it's super interesting, especially just hearing kind of like the inner workings of how the transplant process works and the selection and It's something really interesting. And like you said, we do have a shortage of organs. So just to put in a plug, if you have ever thought about organ donation or like being an organ donor, it's definitely something to consider.
Mm-hmm. Donate life.
Donate life. But yeah, so I think that's it for today's episode. Emily, anything else to add?
Not really. I just want to say transplant is a really cool area to work in, and I really enjoyed it. And it's a super unique, not common area to work in. So if you get the opportunity to work in it, I think, you know, the teams are usually really great, and it's a rewarding experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, awesome. Well, thank you for sharing your knowledge and expertise with us. And we're sign off for the day. So we want to thank Emily for joining us for today's episode. And we hope that you will tune in again soon.
Thanks.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks for listening to Dietitians Only, a podcast produced by Dietitians On Demand. If you need a break today, scroll over to the review section of the podcast and leave us one. Your feedback is the best way to help the podcast grow. Dietitians On Demand employs hundreds of dietitians nationwide and elevates the profession with simple yet effective practice resources, like this podcast. Don't forget to stay connected with us on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram.